from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierengoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Welcome to the Powerline Show. It's Steve Hayward sitting in the anchor chair today, all by myself. It's sometimes quite difficult to get two or three of us together from our scattered locations. And so today's is going to be a little unusual. We won't have our usual banter among us about candidates whose names go bump in the night, nothing about soccer, nothing about Brexit. But we do have a story that we think, and an interview that we think is worth bringing to you right away. So this will be a somewhat short form show. Now, summer is here, and you may not have noticed something unusual. Gasoline prices are actually continuing to go down. Normally, in the summertime, gasoline prices go up because people drive more. And this year, people are driving more than in previous years because the price of gas has been going down following oil prices. Well, what's going on here? A few days ago, I was lucky enough to cross paths with Robert Bryce of the Manhattan Institute, writer extraordinaire on all things energy at National Review Online and elsewhere. And he has an interesting theory that we have now completed a 40-year cycle in the global oil market. And he explains it to us here, along with some other energy subjects. We had our conversation outdoors in, of all places, Marin County, almost literally under the shadow of the Golden Gate Bridge. Anyway, here it is. So I'm sitting outside now with Robert Bryce here in the Marin County headlands just across from the Golden Gate Bridge. We're outside. There's a bit of a wind blowing. There's some foghorns going off in the background as the ships try and get out under the Golden Gate Bridge. And we're going to talk about energy anyway, and you'll just have to bear with the background noise. So good morning, Robert. Great to see you again. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thanks, Steve. It's great to be with you again.
Yeah. So, you know, you're my go-to guy on so many energy things, and you live in Austin. Maybe I should ask you a bit later on about Austin's madness over Uber, but we'll leave that aside for now. I'm interested in your thoughts on the oil cycle we've just gone through. That's been very rapid. We saw prices in February go down to under $30 a barrel with predictions of 10 or 15, which is what I thought meant we've reached the bottom. And now we're back up to 48, 50, something like that. What's your take on the oil cycle we've seen, and where do you think we're going?
Well, I think we're facing some kind of new normal, right, where OPEC is no longer in any kind of position to constrain supply. And that's key because when you look at the history of the oil market, the problem has always been not too little supply but too much. That the key interventions in the market over the last century have been first in the 1930s when the Railroad Commission acted to restrict supply.
Right.
Why? Because there was too much oil in the market. So from the 1930s to 1973, the Railroad Commission would meet every month in Austin to set allowables for Texas producers. And by restricting supply from Texas, which was the world's most important oil province, they restricted supply. 1973, of course, the Yom Kippur War, OPEC took over that role from OPEC by copying the Railroad Commission model exactly.
Right.
So then that all worked, and again until 2014, Thanksgiving Day, the VN meeting of OPEC, Thanksgiving Day 2014, when OPEC effectively said, you know what, we can't control shale oil anymore. We could never control this flow of shale oil. And so this massive increase in shale oil production, which is, we've seen this increase of U.S. production of over 50% in about 4 years, which no one saw coming, added millions of barrels of oil to the global market, and that ended up collapsing prices. So now, effectively, what we have once again is Texas and the other shale oil-producing states in the U.S. becoming the key producers in the global market.
So, you know, when I teach energy policy history to students, first of all, they don't know anything about even the oil crises of the 1970s. They weren't born then.
Sure.
But they're really amazed, and actually even a lot of adults are amazed at what you described about how the object of energy policy in this country, such as we had, was to keep oil prices up.
Right.
Right? Yeah. The problem was the industry was always going to collapse from falling prices.
Exactly, and to avoid the kind of whipsawing effect that we've seen just lately, which was that you had this volatility in the markets that the oil producers couldn't project forward their prices, therefore they couldn't assure cash flow on a consistent basis. And so now, with this whipsaw effect, we've seen all these bankruptcies, all these companies going out of business, and you know, where are the calls to, oh, where, let's save those oil and gas jobs. Instead, instead we hear, oh, all the wind industry jobs, you know, solar jobs, you know, green energy, clean energy jobs. Well, the multiple of jobs that have been lost in the oil and gas sector are many times those of the oil, solar and wind combined.
Right, yeah. So your grand narrative, let me restate what you just said and see if I've got this right. What you're saying is we've really had this 40-year period of sort of the dominance of OPEC, and now we're returning to, in some ways, to the status quo ante. That's a pretty amazing...
Well, it's even status quo even before the days of the Railroad Commission. Then we had the 40-year cycle where the Railroad Commission constrained supply. That was then taken over for roughly 40 years by OPEC. Now we're back effectively to the days immediately after the discovery of the East Texas field in 1930 by Dad Joyner, where there is no effective entity trying to restrict supply of oil into the market.
Right.
So that means who's the marginal producer in terms of cost? And that's going to be the shale producers in the U.S.
Right. Let's switch gears and talk about electricity for a little bit.
Sure.
We have our mutual friends in the environmental movement who've broken with orthodoxy, some of them here in Marin County, to support nuclear power. And the big story out of California this week, of course, is the announced planned closure of our last nuclear power plant. We had three at one point in the state. We were down to one, and in 10 years we'll be down to zero. And Illinois is going to close a couple, apparently, and several others have closed. And, I don't quite understand the economics of the nuclear industry. And is it the case that gas has simply gotten so cheap that it's outcompeting existing nuclear plants, even though the investment has already been sunk, and you'd think you'd want to keep them going longer to get all your capital back? Or is there other things going on?
There are multiple factors in why we're seeing this now, what we have already, not counting Diablo Canyon. I had a piece in the Los Angeles Times last week on this. We have six reactors that are going to close. That's 5 gigawatts of capacity. Well, those 5 gigawatts produce about 40 terawatt hours of electricity per year. Those six reactors produce more zero carbon electricity than every solar plant in the United States. It's more than every solar project in Germany. It's three times as much of the wind output as Denmark. I mean, this is the kind of scale that we're looking at in terms of this zero carbon electricity. And to me, it exposes yet again the hypocrisy of the big green environmental groups and their anti-nuclear stance because, oh, well, climate change trumps everything. Well, if climate change trumps everything, then you should be adamantly pro-nuclear and working to prevent these plants from closing. But that doesn't fit their narrative of we can run the world on solar and wind alone.
Right.
So, I mean, we really are at a remarkable time in the electric market, in the U.S. electric markets, because they are being so distorted by the heavy subsidies for wind and solar,
right?
And also, really, there's no appetite in Washington to do anything to assist the nuclear industry. So, in my view, I think pragmatically, all of these reactors are going to close. There's not going to be any move to save them because there's really no constituency with any power that's going to act to save them.
Let me before asking you a little bit more about the sort of crazy subsidies for wind and how astonishingly perverse they are, I want to think a little bit about the 6 nuclear power plants you mentioned that produce more electricity than all of our wind and solar, or whatever the figures
are. All of the solar in the U.S.
And so I'm just trying to do the back-of-the-envelope calculations in my head, because I keep an envelope in my head.
and you have a big head. There's room for a lot of envelopes in there.
I'm trying to think about all the steel and raw materials involved in that many windmills and that many solar panels, and the land area compared to all the steel and concrete and the land area for nuclear power.
Of course.
That can't possibly pencil out, right? I mean, it seems to me that you use more materials and certainly a ton more land, right?
There's no question. And as I've written in my fourth book, Power Hungry, when you have low power density, you have to make up for it with greater resource intensity. So if you're trying to capture a large amount of energy or create a large amount of energy flow from very diffused energy sources, whether it's the wind, whether it's the sun, and that includes biofuels or solar or wind, right, you have to counteract that by a lot of resource inputs, steel, concrete, copper, etc. So in the case of, to drive this point home, so these 6 reactors that are closing, 40 terawatt hours of electricity production per year, to replace that with wind energy, you would require about 2,100 square miles of land covered in nothing but wind turbines. That's 84 times the size of Marin County.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, four times the size of Marin County. This is, you know, and I don't see any wind turbines in Marin, and I don't think they're going to build any wind turbines here in Marin.
They have the NIMBY thing down pretty well here.
The idea that this is going, you know, that we're going to put in wind turbines in wealthy areas, it's not going to happen. It's all going to be, oh, let's put them somewhere else, you know.
Yeah. Well, now the make sure I got my figures right here. Wind energy gets the $23
per megawatt hour
production tax credit.
Right.
Which means they get paid $23 for every megawatt of power they generate.
Yeah.
And a lot of utilities are required to buy the power, aren't they? Right.
So you get a mandate and a subsidy. You know, I'm a terrible businessman, Steve, but you give me a mandate and a subsidy, I think even I could make money.
Right. But, the power market's funny. People are just used to paying pretty much a uniform price for the electricity they consume. It doesn't vary by time of day.
Yeah.
But for the people generating it and distributing the power, the price they pay on the wholesale market, that varies a lot during the time of day.
It does. And let me put that $23 per megawatt hour into perspective for you. And first, compare it to natural gas, right? We hear all the time from the green left, oh, these unconscionable subsidies given to the oil and gas industry. They've gotten them for decades, and oh, that's just awful, and therefore we should help this nascent industry. Well, nascent industry, okay, wind energy's been around since, I don't know, the 9th century, right? This is not something that's new. We didn't just fall off the turnip truck and say, oh, now I need some help. But $23 per megawatt hour. Okay, how many BTUs per megawatt hour? 3.4 million BTUs per megawatt hour. So $23 per megawatt hour of subsidy, that works out to $6.76 per million BTUs for the wind energy producers.
Yeah.
The price of natural gas today is roughly $2.70. Therefore, the subsidy, just the subsidy for the wind industry, is 2.5 times the market price of natural gas.
Wow.
I mean, this is astounding. Now, let me put it in a different term for you. So, according to the EIA, in 2014 and 2015, the average on-peak wholesale price of electricity in the United States was around $50. So the subsidy, the pre-tax subsidy for the wind industry, is fully nearly half the price of wholesale power in the United States. The after-tax subsidy would be about $30. You're talking about a subsidy of 60% of the wholesale price. One of the reasons why we see the wholesale power markets and the prices in wholesale power markets today in the United States are at 15-year lows.
Right. So let me try and decode that a little bit for those of us who aren't as conversant as you are on this. If the power market works where you bid to sell power into the grid to the utilities who distribute it, and if the market price at any given moment, say, goes down to, say, $30, that's what nuclear industry has to charge, $30, but the wind people get a $23 tax credit, they can offer a bid of $10, right?
Exactly.
And simply undercut everybody.
And exactly right. And that's where the market has been so completely, I don't know a better word, where it's been queered, that you've got this.
We're in the Bay Area. You can say that here.
I can say that.
apparently. Right.
Distorted.
Right.
It's been,
that term's been rehabilitated, I think.
Artificially.
But, enhanced, yeah.
Something. But, yes, and what you see in some markets, including in Texas, is that in some hours, the wind producers are actually bidding negative prices into the grid. In other words, they're paying the grid operator paying them to take their power, because if they don't sell it into the grid, they don't get the production tax credit.
Right.
So, I mean, it's as though you and I are both selling hamburgers, and you don't get a subsidy, but I can say, because I'm getting a federal subsidy for a $4 hamburger that's, say, $2, I can maybe even pay customers to come and eat my it's not a free lunch, it's a lunch I pay people to eat because I'm getting a subsidy.
I think it's a complicated business, but I think if the public could be made to understand this in clear and simple terms, they'd be appalled and shocked, and this would all come to an end.
I wish you were right, but I mean, let's give the solar and wind lobbies their due. They are incredibly effective social marketers.
Yeah.
And you've had, over decades, this conditioning of the American public to hate the oil and gas industry. In fact, hate them with a passion. And you look at the Gallup polls where the approval ratings of the public for oil and gas are lower than those for the federal government.
Right.
Now, that's an achievement.
But
then you also have a very low trust and understanding of the nuclear industry, and here's solar and wind. It just sounds great, and so the public is ready and willing to say, oh, well, of course we need to subsidize them, give them whatever they want. And they just don't understand how electricity works. They don't understand the grid, and therefore, you know, it's fine with them. And the same for the politicians.
So last subject, let's talk a little bit about your next book project. What are you working on? You told me, I think, and let's get a preview.
Yes, sure. I have another contract with Public Affairs. Affairs, my longtime publisher. The book is called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. The idea is simple. Look at how important electricity is in the global market, and not just the global market, but around the world. We in America don't think much about electricity because we always have it. But you have 1.5 billion people roughly around the world who have no access to electricity. And when you look at the world's problems, and in particular the Christian-Muslim divide, you look at the problems of female illiteracy, genital mutilation, any number of different social maladies, they are very closely correlated with electricity availability. So my goal with the book, and maybe even with a video project as well, is to just underscore and show people how important this energy service is. It is the essential ingredient in modernity, and that is it's what separates the rich from the poor. It's what separates the people who are literate from those that are illiterate. It is the essential commodity.
You know, I have a series of photos that I've gotten off the web, but I use with students in the classroom, and maybe I borrowed this from you. I don't remember, but it's photographs from nighttime in Africa, Indonesia, parts of Asia, and what it is it's students sitting under streetlights at night with their books studying because they don't have electricity at home.
I just saw that this morning. It was something on Twitter that Bill Gates put out or something. I don't know where the photo comes from.
Yeah.
You mentioned that the other day, and it was just funny. I just saw that this morning, and I thought, man, this is the another example of this, the essentiality of this incredibly, it's almost magic what we have in electricity today and in America, and the difficulties that the rest of the world is having in coming into the modern age all hinge around their availability, the availability of electricity.
Oh, I love using those photos with students because it has a dual purpose. One is it dramatizes to them energy poverty, right?
Sure.
I mean, the first thing they do when they come into a class is they plug in their laptops and have their phones and stuff. And you know, I was kidding about where does electricity come from? And half of them on the first day, it comes from the wall right there. Isn't that where it comes from?
Yeah.
But then the other thing, too, is I don't make this point, but it's obvious and implied. These students are really motivated and they study really hard, unlike you lazy guys, right?
Yeah.
You know, our students have gotten lazy, so it's fun stuff. So when, what's the timeline? When do we think this will appear?
My deadline's January of 2018. So I think it'll be published in late 18 or early 19 is my goal.
Yeah.
Probably going to go to Africa, maybe to India. I met some people here in Kavala Point from India. India is a very interesting case study where you have 400 million people without access to electricity.
Yeah.
And enormous disparities among the different Indian states in terms of electricity availability.
So,
it's an exciting project, a little daunting, but you know, I love these kind of big topics and going after it.
Gosh, I had a fascinating conversation last night with a fellow here from China named Lee, of course.
Goodness,
because is he a nuclear scientist? Just over cocktails, right? So, but he was saying that China now has, did he say 30 nuclear power plants?
That'd be
and they have 28 under construction.
And even 100 more.
And even at when they finish their 28 in the next 5 years and get them going, they're still going to get 70% of their electricity from coal.
Yeah.
I mean, people say China's this fast-growing market. It's the fastest-growing of everything, right?
Yeah, it's staggering. And that's one of the things that I want to talk about in the book as well is, okay, and I've said this forever, is if we're going to be serious about climate change, we have to be serious about nuclear energy.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that is getting very little traction.
Right.
Wherein right now we have, according to Sierra Club, their numbers, we have 300 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity under construction globally.
Yeah.
That's more than the U.S. had coal-fired capacity a few years ago. So
right.
This idea that we're going to do something effective on climate change here in the U.S. is so incredibly myopic when you look at what's happening around the rest of the world in the coal market. It deserves a lot more attention than it's getting.
Right. Robert Bryce, thank you very much, and I'll look forward to catching up with you when juice is flowing in the bookstores.
Thanks, Steve.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com. Oh, no.